Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the place where we cut through all the noise, we take a stack of dense source material, and we turn it into clear, concise, and, well, most importantly, usable insight for you.
And today, we have, one of the most remarkable collections of sources we've ever put together. It all seems to be pointing to this moment of extreme velocity, where tech, finance, and geopolitics are all just converging so rapidly.
That is absolutely right. We're going to be dissecting, article by article, all the information inside the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, November 19th, 2025. My name is Alex Vanderbilt, and I'll be your guide through this really extraordinary set of documents today.
And I'm Sam Astor, ready to help connect the dots on what is a very high-stakes day of news.
Our mission for you, the learner, is, well, it's straightforward, but it's massive. We need to extract the crucial insights from this single day that really define the cutting edge of global instability and innovation. We have to understand how this AI race is creating market volatility and these surprising new infrastructure demands.
And at the same time, how regulators are scrambling and, you know, often failing to keep up with big tech, and how political lines, both here at home and internationally, are just being redrawn in real time.
It's a huge mandate. So let's just unpack this immediately. Let's start with the frenetic financial pace of this accelerating AI race.
Right. When we dive into these lead stories, the numbers being thrown around in the AI sphere are just, they're staggering. The headline news is all about this massive strategic partnership. It involves three giants, NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Anthropic.
And this isn't some small seed round. We're talking about, the journal says, tens of billions of dollars. All of it dedicated to building out the computing infrastructure that's going to define the future.
Here's where the financial engineering gets.
Well, it gets complicated, and it almost immediately raised some red flags for market analysts. The reports detail this almost circular financing mechanism.
Okay, so break that down for us. What does circular mean here? So get this. NVIDIA and Microsoft are jointly investing up to $15 billion into Anthropic. And remember, Anthropic is a key competitor to OpenAI.
The same OpenAI that Microsoft has already poured billions into. That's complex.
It's very complex. But here's the circular part. Anthropic, in turn, commits to using that investment and more, a lot more, to buy a whopping $30 billion of computing capacity over the next few years.
And where are they buying it from? Let me guess.
Microsoft Azure. Their cloud service. And what's it running on? The very latest NVIDIA chips, of course, the Grace Blackwell and the future Vera Rubin systems.
So let me see if I have this loop right. Microsoft and NVIDIA pay $15 billion to a competitor, Anthropic. And that basically guarantees Anthropic has to turn around and spend double that, $30 billion, back on their own cloud services and their own chips. Is that an investment?
Yeah.
Or is it more like a massive prepaid expense that's just designed to lock in future revenue and market share?
Well, it functions as both, really. But the risk profile is what caused the immediate market jitters. Microsoft and NVIDIA shares, they both dropped nearly 3% on the day of the announcement.
And the concern is what? That this isn't organic growth.
Precisely. It's not driven by some external customer demand. It's a form of circular financing that suggests this AI infrastructure bubble might be propped up by these internal, highly interconnected deals.
So if Anthropic fails to deliver on its value, Microsoft and NVIDIA are on the hook as both the investor and the capacity provider.
Right. They're left holding the bag. It suggests, I think, a certain desperation to lock down that consumption capacity right now.
And what's so fascinating is that this cooperation is happening, even though there's all this intense philosophical, even political friction between the leaders. We just said it. Microsoft is the primary investor in OpenAI, which is Anthropic's biggest rival.
And we have documented public clashes between NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang and Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei.
The differences there are pretty stark, aren't they? They really expose some of the underlying tensions in the whole industry.
Oh, yeah. Amodei at Anthropic has been really vocal. He's criticized both the Trump administration and Huang for continuing to export these cutting-edge AI chips to places like China and the Middle East. He calls them strategic national resources.
He sees it as a national security risk.
A huge one. And Huang, he just dismisses Amodei's perspective entirely. He pushes back hard, suggesting that Amodei's focus on AI's, quote, scary potential and the need for all this regulation might just be a strategy.
A strategy to slow the industry down so Anthropic can catch up.
Or maybe control the entire output. That's the implication. And meanwhile, Amodei has publicly predicted these truly massive white-collar job losses from AGI, which Huang just calls alarmist.
So you have these two giants. They fundamentally disagree on AI's role in society. the ethics, the geopolitical risks.
Everything. But the sheer necessity of building out this infrastructure, it forces them to collaborate. NVIDIA needs Anthropic to buy its chips, and Anthropic needs Microsoft's cloud to run the models. It's an oligopoly of desperate, high-stakes cooperation.
A high-stakes world where, it seems, noise and hypervaluation are the norm. And that brings us to Elon Musk's xAI, which somehow manages to make that Microsoft-NVIDIA partnership look restrained.
Yeah, xAI is making headlines for being in advanced talks to raise $15 billion. But the headline figure, the one that makes you blink, is the stunning $230 billion valuation tied to that round.
That is just a dizzying jump from just a few months earlier. Wasn't it valued around $113 billion when it merged with the social media site X?
It was. This new valuation, it's built entirely on promised future capabilities, specifically the construction of this colossus data center in Memphis, which Musk promises will be the largest computing complex in the world.
And in classic Musk fashion, the moment a CNBC report on this valuation hits the wire, he tweets.
A single cryptic word, false, in response to a post about the story. Which, you know, adds another layer of uncertainty. Most analysts think the talks are real, and that maybe false refers to some specific detail.
But it just underscores how volatile this company is, burning immense amounts of cash in pursuit of that infrastructure.
And you see Musk trying to leverage his entire corporate ecosystem to feed this thing. SpaceX already put $2 billion into xAI, and he's publicly floated the idea of Tesla investing too.
Despite a pretty mixed response from shareholders, right? And the fact that Tesla's own chair, Robin Denholm, said the board hasn't even done the due diligence on such a huge cross-corporate investment.
It just shows you the depth of the hunger for capital. The AI itself is the product, but the commodity driving the value right now is just raw compute power. And that requires billions in upfront cash, forcing these complex, sometimes convoluted financial deals.
And right in the middle of all this aggressive action, you've got Google or Alphabet desperately trying to close the gap.
Exactly. They just launched Gemini 3, the latest version of their large language model, and this launch feels highly aggressive. It's specifically aimed at catching up with OpenAI and this newly funded Anthropic.
The reports say Gemini 3 is much more sophisticated, especially with coding and image generation.
It is. And what's fascinating here, there's a little anecdote in the source material about an internal tool they call Nano Banana.
Nano Banana.
Yeah. Google quietly released this internal image generation tool on a public platform, and it immediately shot to the top of the leaderboard. It's generated over 5 billion images since August alone.
Wow. So that internal success clearly lit a fire under the C-suite to push Gemini 3 out the door faster.
For sure. They're trying to use that demonstrable capability to regain ground in this arms race. This whole dynamic, the circular deals, the hypervaluations, the frantic releases, it's all driven by sheer velocity. And as that speed increases, regulators are struggling to apply the brakes.
Which brings us directly to a colossal piece of legal news.
Yes, the Meta antitrust victory. This is a monumental decision, and it raises some really serious questions about how effective government oversight can be in the tech sector anymore.
So this was a huge win for Facebook's parent company, Meta.
A decisive one. A federal judge completely dismissed the Federal Trade Commission's claims that Meta holds an illegal social media monopoly. This basically gutted one of the government's biggest, highest-profile antitrust suits against a major tech company in decades.
And what was the core failure of the FTC's case, according to the judge?
Well, according to the ruling from Judge James Boasberg, it was the FTC's inability to prove that Meta currently holds monopoly power. They tried to define the market very narrowly. They argued, you know, that Facebook and Instagram, which are about connecting with friends and family, are totally distinct from video-focused apps.
But the judge didn't buy that.
Not at all. He pointed squarely at TikTok, saying it holds center stage as Meta's fiercest rival. And that's the crucial legal point. The court said Meta hasn't stood still. It's transformed its products, adding things like Reels, serving up tons of video, basically mirroring the TikTok trend.
So in the eyes of the court, since they compete for the same user attention, Meta can't possibly be a monopoly.
Exactly. And it just highlights how hard it is for antitrust officials in these fast-moving tech markets. I mean, the FTC's legal fight here has been going on since 2020. By the time it went to trial, the market had evolved so much that the lawsuit's premise was kind of obsolete.
Innovation just outpaced the litigation.
Completely. And you have to think about the stakes. Had Meta lost, the consequences would have been catastrophic for them. The FTC wanted to force them to unwind the Instagram and WhatsApp acquisitions.
Which would have been what, financially?
Analysts estimate they could have lost nearly half their annual revenue. We're talking tens of billions of dollars. A loss like that would have crippled their ability to fund the massive AI expansion we were just talking about. This victory preserves their war chest and keeps them in the game.
And that anxiety, this feeling that these companies are too big, too fast, and kind of immune to normal regulation, that's not just in the legal system. It's a real, widespread public feeling. Which brings us to a really compelling op-ed by Greg Ipp about the dread hanging over the AI revolution.
This piece draws a stark, almost shocking historical contrast. If you go back to the dot-com era, say 1995, something like 72% of people were comfortable with new tech like the internet.
And today, with AI,
it has completely flipped. A striking 68% of Americans are uncomfortable with the rise of artificial intelligence. Only 31% say they're comfortable.
So the article digs into why. Why this profound sense of dread?
It suggests the optimism is confined to a very narrow slice of the economy. You know, the AI architects, the C-suite execs, who see this technology as a way to reduce headcount and boost profits.
Meanwhile, the average worker is just intensely focused on the fear of being replaced.
The stats bear that out. We've seen big layoff rounds from Meta, Microsoft, Amazon. At the same time, the market cap of the Magnificent Seven tech stocks, the ones tied to AI, is up 169% since ChatGPT was released.
So the stock market is hitting new records, but the worker feels insecure. The wealth from AI is flowing into a very concentrated area.
And the technology itself adds to the dread. It's not like an assembly line robot. Even the people who build these models admit they aren't totally sure why they produce the results they do. It defies easy human understanding, which makes it feel uncontrollable.
The piece even cites a Yale economist, Pasquale Restrepo, who outlines a pretty terrifying long-term scenario.
Yeah, he asks, what happens if AGI can do everything humans can do? His model suggests the workers' share of GDP, which is around 52% in the U.S. now, would, quote, converge to zero. All income would eventually go to the owners of the computers.
That's a recipe for profound economic anxiety.
And that fear translates directly into political pressure. Only 40% of Americans trust the AI industry. 57% demand more government regulation. We even see President Trump responding to the other side of that, rescinding AI safety guidelines to prioritize competition with China over caution.
The op-ed uses a striking historical parallel to wrap this all up, comparing AI to nuclear power.
Right. Nuclear power after World War II promised limitless cheap energy. There was decades of optimism, but then came overwhelming public opposition, really crystallized after the 1979 Three Mile Island accident, and that just halted nuclear deployment in the U.S. for decades.
Potential was sidelined by panic.
Precisely. And what's so incredible is that this parallel isn't just philosophical, it's literal. The only thing powerful enough to drag nuclear power back into the center of U.S. energy policy is the very technology causing all this anxiety, AI.
Which gives us the perfect transition to a massive development in U.S. domestic policy and infrastructure.
We're talking about the restart of Three Mile Island. I mean, a deeply symbolic move that links the modern quest for AI dominance directly to a painful chapter in American energy history.
That's right. The Trump administration is giving Constellation Energy a $1 billion federal loan to restart the second reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. And just to remind you, this is the site of the partial core meltdown in 1979, the worst civilian nuclear accident in U.S. history.
The public rationale from Energy Secretary Chris Wright is, you know, the standard goals, lower electricity prices, support reshore manufacturing. The administration is making a huge long-term bet on nuclear, vowing to quadruple U.S. nuclear generation by 2050.
But the immediate catalyst, the real reason for restarting this specific reactor, is a single immense customer.
Microsoft. Constellation has signed a 20-year deal to sell all 800 megawatts of power generated by this reactor exclusively to Microsoft.
It just underlines the terrifying energy footprint of this AI race. 800 megawatts. That's enough to power hundreds of thousands of homes.
And Microsoft needs that reliable 247 carbon-free power for its massive, ever-expanding AI data centers. Old gas plants or, you know, intermittent renewables like wind and solar, they just can't guarantee the uptime and the density of power you need to run these advanced chip clusters.
So the pursuit of AI isn't just a financial story, it's an infrastructure story. and is forcing the U.S. to resurrect decades-old energy sources that were sidelined by fear.
And this perception of nuclear is changing globally, too. You see it in Europe, where the war in Ukraine exposed how fragile their reliance on Russian gas was. France, Japan, the U.K., they're all dramatically expanding their nuclear grids now.
It's a multi-billion-dollar bet that the power demands of AI are just going to obliterate previous energy consumption models. It's pushing us back to the biggest, most reliable, and, well, most controversial sources we have.
From the resurrection of energy infrastructure, let's look at the shifting sands of political power, specifically within the Republican Party, where the president's influence seems to be showing its first significant cracks.
We saw a genuine political milestone in Congress with the overwhelming approval to release the Jeffrey Epstein files.
And this was forced through by a bipartisan coalition, basically running around the president's initial opposition. He had called the effort a Democrat-driven campaign to embarrass Republicans. His last-minute pivot to support the bill felt like a full surrender to avoid a massive GOP defection.
But the real drama was the increasingly public feud between the president and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was once one of his staunchest allies. Greene became the champion of releasing the files,
which prompted a huge public attack from the president. He called her a ranting lunatic, Marjorie Traitor Greene, and he threatened to back a primary challenger against her. I mean, this kind of public aggressive divorce from a major ally is a big signal.
And Greene's response was fascinatingly strategic. She sort of maintained this posture of forgiveness, saying she'd pray for him, but she also emphasized that this fight has ripped Maggie apart.
And then, in this surreal political twist, Greene, who built her career on incendiary rhetoric, was actually being praised by the mostly liberal hosts of The View for softening her persona and focusing on populist issues. She even apologized for taking part in toxic politics.
It suggests a fundamental shift in her own strategy, maybe capitalizing on her newfound distance from the president.
And this fracturing isn't just internal GOP drama, it's also showing up in these external legal defeats. We saw the blocking of that new Texas congressional map.
Yes, a 3-judge federal panel blocked the use of that map. And that map was designed specifically at the president's request to create as many as 5 new GOP House seats. It would have dramatically strengthened the party's hand.
But the injunction was sought by groups arguing the map violated the Voting Rights Act by systematically diluting the power of Latino and Black votes. Now, Texas is appealing to the Supreme Court, but for now, it's a significant block to the party's efforts, a costly defeat.
And while all this is happening, the Federal Reserve is trying to navigate a genuinely cloudy economic picture. A recent government shutdown delayed a lot of key data releases.
Right. Richmond Fed President Thomas Barkin said the Fed's dual mandate controlling inflation while maximizing employment is under pressure in this data sparse patch. We did get a few signals, though. ADP reported private sector job losses slowed way down, and factory orders were resilient. But overall, the path for the December rate decision is still very cloudy.
That economic fog immediately leads us overseas. If domestic politics feels complex, the foreign policy dance happening at the White House right now is a study in transactional realpolitik, especially with Saudi Arabia.
We have to talk about the visit of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. This was his first White House visit since the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, an event that made him an international pariah. The optics here were clearly designed to solidify his rehabilitation.
And President Trump openly contradicted the CIA's assessment that MBS ordered the killing. He just said flat out he knew nothing about it, and then called him one of the most respected leaders in the world.
The whole visit was highly transactional. It was about cementing a multi-billion-dollar relationship across defense, energy, and tech. First up was the F-35 fighter jet deal. Trump announced Saudi Arabia would be buying advanced F-35s.
And this is a complex and deeply controversial deal. The U.S. is legally required to maintain Israel's qualitative military edge in the region. Giving advanced stealth fighters to Saudi Arabia directly threatens that calculus.
Plus, Saudi Arabia has deepening military ties with China, which raises serious espionage concerns. The last attempt to sell F-35s to the UAE got tanked because of that exact issue. This deal is lucrative, sure, but it forces a massive geopolitical risk calculation.
Beyond defense, there were 2 key energy and tech deals signed.
A memorandum on the framework for U.S. help in developing a civilian nuclear industry. But critically, it left the most thorny issue unclear, whether Saudi Arabia would be allowed to enrich uranium on its own soil,
which would give them a near path to a nuclear weapon. a major sticking point for Congress.
And then a separate agreement granting Riyadh more access to American AI technologies, bringing us right back to where we started. And MBS also raised his investment pledge in the U.S. to a massive $1 trillion.
To really get the power dynamics, you just have to look at the guest list for the White House dinner. It wasn't just diplomats, it was titans of tech. Elon Musk, Tim Cook from Apple, Greg Brockman from OpenAI, Jensen Huang from NVIDIA.
That guest list tells you everything. This geopolitical alignment is fundamentally driven by high finance and access to cutting-edge tech. MBS is buying access and status with investment pledges, and the American tech world is eager to sell.
And tying the political and the personal together, the sources detailed a new Trump Organization plan for a branded resort in the Maldives, The Partner, a Saudi-owned developer, Dar Global. The timing raises immediate ethics concerns.
And what's really notable is the funding mechanism. They plan to tokenize the development using a crypto-like vehicle where fractional ownership is logged on a digital blockchain.
Okay, break that down. Why is tokenization important in this context?
Well, traditional real estate financing involves big banks. They require extensive due diligence, disclosure of funding sources, they follow strict regulations. Tokenization basically bypasses that whole system.
So they can raise capital without the usual scrutiny.
Precisely. By selling these digital tokens to smaller private investors globally via the blockchain, they can raise huge amounts of money without the oversight of major US and European financial institutions. It allows for a less transparent flow of capital into politically sensitive projects.
From those massive geopolitical deals, let's widen the lens and look at the global economic fallout from the recent rise in U.S. tariffs.
The initial phase of tariffs has had a lighter impact on overall global growth than many had feared. But the impact is significant and uneven. Global growth is now projected to decelerate in the second half of 2025.
And we saw specific countries contract in the third quarter because of these higher U.S. import taxes.
Yeah.
Japan and Switzerland saw their economy shrink. Mexico and Ireland, two big export hubs to the U.S., also contracted.
So what's prevented a full-blown global recession? Really, two things. First, the surge in investment related to AI. Countries are importing huge quantities of semiconductors and servers. That demand is massive enough to prop up trade figures.
And the second thing?
The absence of retaliation. Most targeted countries feared triggering a full-scale trade war, so they held back, which has kept global supply chains relatively intact, for now.
That reliance on American tech, even while getting hit by American tariffs, it just fuels this desire for digital independence, which takes us to a major global shift, Europe's race for digital sovereignty.
This is a fundamental pivot in Europe's strategy. Historically, the EU has been the global rule setter for tech. Think of GDPR, the big data privacy regulation. But they were often criticized for stifling innovation.
And now they're moving to relax some of those rules.
In a clear bid to boost their own growth and reduce reliance on U.S. tech giants, the European Commission is planning to make it much easier for companies to use data to train AI models. France and Germany are leading the charge, pushing to postpone AI compliance deadlines and even relax parts of GDPR.
The German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, called this a litmus test for the fight against red tape.
He basically said Europe needs to innovate before it regulates if it wants to compete with the U.S. and China. The fear is that if Europe doesn't develop its own tech champions, it will be permanently relegated to being just a consumer and regulator of foreign technology.
And while Europe is trying to dial back U.S. dominance, China is actively building parallel financial systems to evade it. And we see that in a quiet, fascinating experiment happening in Myanmar.
This is a direct infrastructural challenge to the U.S. dollar-dominated financial system. China is helping Myanmar's military junta build a digital payment system using the digital yuan, the ECNY, and the infrastructure is from Huawei and a major Chinese bank, ICBC.
And the key here is that this new system uses China's own payment system, CIPS, which completely bypasses the U.S.-monitored SWIFT network.
Right. And in Myanmar, where the economy is mostly cash-based and chaotic, that actually makes large-scale sanctions evasion hard. But a fully digitized currency, the ECAIET, it removes that cash bottleneck. It allows for seamless systemic evasion of U.S. sanctions at scale.
So military companies under sanctions could access dollars through Chinese banks and CIPS, and it would be incredibly hard for the U.S. Treasury to trace or freeze anything.
Analysts see this as Beijing laying the literal groundwork, the financial plumbing, for a post-American world. It's chipping away at the foundation of U.S. financial dominance. The report is urgent, saying the U.S. Treasury needs to warn banks to cut ties with ICBC before this parallel system gets too big.
Now let's move from these macro global systems to issues affecting American consumers directly. And this starts with a severe crisis in healthcare known as Medicaid ghost networks.
This is a deeply disturbing report on the failures of managed care. Private Medicaid insurers, which cover over 70 million low-income Americans, are systematically listing doctor networks that are far less robust, in many cases entirely fake, than they claim.
The Wall Street Journal's analysis is damning. They cross-referenced insurer filings with actual Medicaid claims across 22 states, and they found that more than a third of the doctors listed in these networks didn't treat the insurer's Medicaid patients at all last year.
And the problem is most acute where patients need help the most: specialty care. For psychiatry, it's devastating. 54% of listed psychiatrists were inactive. They saw zero or very few of the plan's members. The human impact is just. It's immediate.
The story details the case of a 9-year-old boy, Trent Davis, who has autism and ADHD. His mother desperately sought a child psychiatrist. Her insurer, Centene, claimed to have 28 in-network doctors nearby.
But the journal's analysis showed 11 of those saw no patients and 9 saw 10 or fewer. She was ultimately put on a 12 to 18 month wait list.
Another example was a 60-year-old man, John Whitfield, suffering from severe gout. He couldn't find a single rheumatologist accepting new Medicaid patients in his area, even though 7 were listed. His conclusion was just tragic. He said, "If you're on Medicaid, don't get sick."
And it all comes down to a flawed incentive structure. These ghost networks exist because doctors are paid dramatically less for Medicaid visits. In New Jersey, the median payment for a moderate visit was $48 for Medicaid versus $143 for a commercial patient.
So doctors are forced into what they call economic triage. They just can't afford to take on many Medicaid patients.
Meanwhile, the insurers have a perverse incentive to list these big but fictional networks to win state contracts. They meet the contractual obligation for network size, but they aren't penalized enough for the functional absence of care. It leaves the patient stranded.
From the clinic to the skies, another consumer safety issue is finally getting some traction. Toxic fumes in aviation, often called fume events.
Yeah, after years of reports of sick passengers and long-term injuries to crew, airlines and engine makers are finally deploying concrete measures to curb toxic fumes oil and other fluids leaking into cabins through the bleed air system.
And what's shocking is the huge data discrepancy that's existed for years. Internal industry data shows these toxic leaks happen on about 800 flights per million departures. That's up to 22 times a day in the U.S.
Which is way, way above the FAA's official estimate of fewer than 33 events per million. The industry has been dramatically underreporting the scope of this problem.
But now we are seeing real, costly solutions. American Airlines is installing a $50,000 per aircraft retrofit from Airbus on its A320s. Lufthansa is testing a new, safer engine oil.
And Congress is finally acting. The Air Travelers' Right to Know Act has been reintroduced. It pushes the FAA for better reporting standards, mandated sensors, and requires airlines to disclose the risks to passengers. The long fight for transparency is finally yielding some results.
These systemic safety issues often contrast sharply with simple consumer success stories, which brings us to a much lighter but still high-stakes story about secrets and successful branding. The core of Raising Cane's success.
Raising Cane's chicken fingers has just exploded. $5.1 billion in sales last year. And all that success, that massive valuation, it's built around one deceptively simple thing: the famous Cane's sauce.
The secrecy around this sauce is legendary. It's intentionally designed to mimic the mystique of, like, KFC's 11 herbs and spices. The original recipe is the only physical copy, and it's locked in a safe somewhere.
The managers who mix the sauce have to sign NDAs. The ingredients are shipped in unmarked bags with a pre-blended spice mix, so even the people making it don't know the exact formula.
And the sauce has become their unique selling proposition. Fans, who call themselves Caniacs, insist it's what makes them wait in line.
And they are truly fanatical. Customers will order huge drink-sized cups of the sauce for like $8 and transfer it to soup containers to use at home on steak, burritos, everything.
The company goes through an estimated 800 million 4-ounce cups of sauce a year. And management just allows this extreme consumer behavior because they're committed to finding a yes for their customers. That brand mystique is what separates them.
That strong consumer connection built on trust takes us to our final health segment, a significant long-awaited shift in hormonal therapy guidance that aims to rebuild trust lost decades ago.
The FDA is calling for the removal of the dreaded black box, warning from all forms of menopausal hormone therapy, or HRT. This is massive news. The popularity of HRT just plummeted after that 2003 Women's Health Initiative trial linked it to increased health risks.
Right. That black box warning, the FDA's strongest, it essentially implied the treatment was universally dangerous. Since then, millions of women who could have benefited have avoided it.
Now, doctors and researchers largely agree that removing the warning from local estrogen products is long overdue. That's the stuff used topically that has minimal absorption. It's considered very safe.
The controversy is with systemic estrogen for hot flashes and bone loss, which circulates through the bloodstream. It still carries risks, but doctors argued the black box warning was an overreaction to a flawed study. The study mostly looked at older, postmenopausal women who started therapy years after menopause began.
So the consensus now is that it's best initiated around the time of menopause when a woman is younger than 60.
Right. Women over 60 or more than 10 years postmenopause are generally advised against it. But this change will help clinicians and patients make informed decisions without all that unnecessary alarm.
This entire deep dive is framed by market volatility and data scarcity. And right now, Wall Street is operating in a fog, waiting for two absolutely critical signals this week to figure out the market's next move.
The first, and arguably the most crucial given our discussion, is NVIDIA's earnings report, which is due out Wednesday. This report is the ultimate acid test for the current AI trade mania. Investors are waiting to see if the demand for those chips can possibly justify the stratospheric valuations.
There is palpable nervousness. We know influential players like Peter Thiel's macro fund recently dumped a lot of shares. Investors need concrete confirmation that demand is meeting these massive expenditures.
And the second critical signal is the delayed September jobs report, finally coming out on Thursday. The combination of NVIDIA's performance and the official jobs data will provide critical signals for the Fed and investors, and it should finally pierce some of this economic fog.
Moving to some specific corporate headlines. We saw some very big money trading hands in the world of high art and big deals.
Gustav Klimt's portrait of Elizabeth Lederer sold for a historic $236.4 million at Sotheby's. That makes it the most expensive modern artwork ever sold at auction. It's a real signal of confidence among the ultra-high net worth segment.
And on the slightly more unusual side, a solid gold toilet fetched $12.1 million. So there's that.
On the corporate consolidation front, AkzoNobel and Axalta Coating Systems agreed to an all-stock merger. This creates a global paint giant with a market value of about $17 billion, a clear move toward consolidation in that sector.
And in pharma, Roche shares were up big, 6.8%, after its experimental pill for estrogen-driven breast cancer showed highly positive results in a late-stage trial. Analysts think it could capture around $5 billion in annual sales.
We also saw key corporate adjustments reflecting shifting consumer tastes. Panera Bread is undertaking a big turnaround strategy. After years of stagnant sales, the CEO is aiming to boost annual sales to $7 billion by 2028.
And the most relatable change is a menu overhaul. Panera had swapped in cheaper iceberg lettuce, which the CEO is now reversing back to romaine. His sentiment was pretty clear. No one likes iceberg. It's about reversing cuts to quality that alienated their core customers.
And at the same time, Toyota is investing $912 million to increase hybrid vehicle production in the U.S. It's a direct response to growing consumer demand for hybrids, driven partly by the expiration of some EV tax credits. They're meeting the market where it is.
We started this deep dive talking about the dizzying acceleration of AI, which now brings us back to a sector still deeply wounded by structural changes, commercial real estate. And here again, AI casts a very large shadow.
Yeah, the picture in office space is dire. The U.S. office vacancy rate is 14.1%, near a record high. And crucially, this is no longer seen as a cyclical dip. It's a structural slump, driven by remote and hybrid work.
We're seeing a strikingly uneven recovery. Trophy districts, like Park Avenue in New York, are seeing some turnaround. But most cities are just burdened with obsolete empty space.
This is leading to massive financial capitulation. Big property owners are handing buildings back to lenders or selling at huge losses. They're finally acknowledging that the market value of these assets will not recover.
And the final layer of uncertainty is AI. Tens of thousands of corporate jobs have been eliminated this year, replaced or enhanced by AI. And the crucial question is, will any new jobs AI creates be the kind that require a five-day-a-week office presence?
As one analyst put it, that's a huge uncertainty. AI is now cited as a core structural threat to future office demand, and it's permanently reshaping urban economies.
Finally, we turn to the high-stakes world of sports finance, which is seeing its own battles over institutional control versus private capital.
The Big Ten's massive proposed $2.4 billion private investment deal with UC Investments has been abruptly halted. This deal was supposed to offer each school at least $100 million and pool their media rights until 2046.
But it hit a wall with the University of Michigan Regents. They pushed back hard, arguing the Big Ten commissioner overstepped his authority and failed to inform them about this massive, decades-long commitment. The Regents worried about selling our soul to private capital.
And the drama intensified when the commissioner allegedly threatened to reduce Michigan's revenue share if they didn't agree. The whole thing is paused now. It just perfectly illustrates the immense financial pressures in college sports.
And tucked away in the sports section is one final, delightful detail on niche mastery. It shows how one player's skill can redefine a team. The unexpected success of the Houston Rockets, built on the back of Steven Adams.
Adams, who's technically a backup center, has become the NBA's most dominant force in offensive rebounding. He averages a staggering 5.1 offensive rebounds per game. He ensures the Rockets grab over 40% of their own missed shots.
He calls it trench work. He says he studied where missed shots tend to land. And his mastery of winning those extra possessions has turned the Rockets into the NBA's most efficient offense, better than star-studded teams like the Lakers or the Warriors.
His value is in the demoralizing effect. You guard for the whole shot clock, force a tough shot, and then Adams just renders all that effort moot. It's an unusual strategy built on the mastery of a single crucial niche.
What a detailed and comprehensive deep dive. If we look back across everything from November 19th, the themes are just dizzying. The intense velocity of AI investment, the difficulty of regulating big tech, and the surprising way-old infrastructure like Three Mile Island is being resurrected to power this new future.
And running through all of it is this complex dance of geopolitics. The transactional Saudi reset, the ethical questions around that Maldives tokenization deal, and China actively building financial plumbing to challenge the U.S. dollar.
The common thread, whether we look at macro finance or individual patient stories, seems to be a struggle for control. GOP members testing presidential control, the Big Ten fighting for control over its financial future, and Medicaid patients losing control over their own health.
The stakes are global, they're financial, and they are intensely personal.
So as we wrap up, consider this provocative thought for you, the listener. The rise of artificial intelligence is simultaneously driving this unprecedented investment in U.S. power generation restarting Three Mile Island for Microsoft's data centers, while at the same time, AI is being cited as a core reason why commercial office demand may never recover. What other obsolete or even dangerous infrastructure, previously rejected by society, will the AI boom unexpectedly resurrect or transform in its endless quest for power and data?
A fascinating and critical question to carry forward as we watch this all unfold. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
We look forward to having you back next time for another deep dive into the headlines.